This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Hello, I'm Gabriel Gatehouse. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast from Friday, the 27th of September. Dame Maggie Smith, one of the great British actors and queen of the put-down, has died aged 89. We'll look back at her life and speak to Michael Palin. Also in this edition, airstrikes in Beirut as Benjamin Netanyahu makes an impassioned and angry speech at the United Nations in New York. Not a single mention of the word ceasefire. And Wimbledon. Plans have been approved for a huge expansion of the All England Club. One local woman, 99 years old, tells us she'll chain herself to the trees to stop it from going ahead. You're listening to The World Tonight with Gabriel Gatehouse. Airstrikes in Beirut, a fiery speech at the United Nations in New York. That's coming up. But first, Maggie Smith. No one did a better put down.
You are quite wonderful the way you see room for improvement wherever you look. I never knew such reforming zeal.
I take that as a compliment.
I must have said it wrong.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I thought you were a waiter.
I have no wish to be a great lady.
No, a decision that must be reinforced whenever you look in the glass.
If I'm going to the theatre, then I ought to change.
Yes, I should. When I'm with her, I'm reminded of the virtues of the English.
But isn't she American?
Exactly. Your quarrel is with my daughter Rosamond, not me. So put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Some highlights of the acid-tongued Dowager Countess in ITV's Downton Abbey. Maggie Smith's long and versatile career spanned more than six decades, starting on stage, doing musical comedy opposite Kenneth Williams in the 1950s, and Shakespeare with Laurence Olivier in the 60s, all the way to the Harry Potter films in more recent years, with the likes of Ingmar Bergman and Franco Zeffirelli in between. She was versatile and wide-ranging, but Dame Maggie did develop what you might call an archetype. As she said herself, "It's true, I don't tolerate fools. But then they don't tolerate me, so I'm spiky. Maybe that's why I'm quite good at playing spiky elderly ladies." You can say that again. In a minute, we'll get the reflections of Sir Michael Palin. But first, here's our culture editor, Katie Razzle, on the life of one of Britain's greatest actors.
Little girls, I am in the business of putting old heads on young shoulders.
Maggie Smith in the prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
I am dedicated to you in my prime.
She won an Oscar for her portrayal of a maverick teacher in 1930s Edinburgh, though with typical wry humour, she claimed it did her little good.
It's had absolutely no effect on my career whatsoever, I have to say. Because when I did get it for Best Actress, I didn't think I worked again in films for years.
In fact, she appeared in five films over the next 10 years and won another Oscar for California Suite, playing an actress who has been nominated for an Academy Award.
I have a definite hump on my left shoulder. It costs £500 and I look like Richard III. Do you notice the hump, Sydney?
Maggie Smith had already become a star as a classical actress on the stage and on TV in roles such as Portia in The Merchant of Venice.
If he lose, he makes a swan-like end fading in music.
She was versatile, even singing and dancing in Oh, What a Lovely War.
But on Saturday I'm willing, if you'll only take the shilling, to make a man of anyone.
But she had a particular genius for comedy.
I prefer acting in straight plays, but I find that comedy is much easier for me personally.
For Maggie Smith, serious acting and comedy weren't so far apart. Here she is in Alan Bennett's Talking Heads, playing the quietly desperate wife of a vicar.
The sermon was about sex.
I didn't actually nod off, though I had heard it before.
She played some of her best-loved characters in her 70s, including Professor McGonagall in the Harry Potter films.
Now, today, we will be transforming animals into water goblets.
Well, as you'd expect, tributes to Dame Maggie are continuing to come in. The King and Queen said, "As the curtain comes down on a national treasure, we join all those around the world in remembering with the fondest admiration and affection her many great performances and her warmth and wit that shone through both off and on the stage." Hugh Bonneville, who played the Earl of Grantham in Downton Abbey, spoke of her sharp eye and formidable talent. Dame Kirsten Scott-Thomas, who starred alongside her in Gosford Park, said she had a sense of humour that could reduce me to blithering puddles of giggles. Sir Michael Palin knew Maggie Smith. They were the same generation, and they acted alongside each other on a number of occasions. I spoke to Sir Michael earlier and began by asking him about his memories of working with her.
Just her sublime skill at portraying so much with so little effort. You know, she was just a marvellous sort of instinctively gifted actor. And being with her, you just knew that you always had an uphill task to stay with her. And if you got it right and if you played it well together, it was a wonderful experience. She was really good to work with, but as I say, one had to keep up to the mark.
Richard Burton accused her of upstaging him. Grand larceny, he called it.
Yes, I do know that Laurence Olivier had to slap her at some point or appear to. He hit her so hard one night. One of the other actors shouted out, "Oh, Mags, are you all right?"
My goodness, is this in the infamous Othello?
Yes, the two roles I played with were both sort of comedy roles, really. And I was just able to watch her terrific skill at comic timing. I mean, there's no one really apart from, I suppose, John Cleese, who I've acted with, that has such absolute gift of precise comic timing and getting the absolute most out of the least.
Well, since you mentioned your comic roles with her, can I take on a little trip down memory lane?
Yeah.
So this is from the 1984 film, A Private Function, and you and Maggie Smith are stuck in a kitchen with a pig. Let's have a little listen.
Listen, Gilbert Chilvers. This country has just emerged from a Second World War, a war where millions of people died, most of them killed by their fellow men.
Not with Chiropodist tools.
No. It's not the tools, it's the will. He's doing his business again.
I love that line. It's not the tools, it's the will.
Yeah, not with Chiropodist tools. Very, very good.
But that seems like such a Maggie Smith put down, which became her USP, if you like, her sort of entire persona. Was she like that in real life? Was she acid-tongued?
She had a sharp wit, to put it that way. And she would use it with devastating accuracy sometimes. I think that was just because she was so good at what she did that she became slightly impatient with other people who were fussing around and making it complicated. She certainly didn't suffer fools. It was joyous sometimes, but I think occasionally her acting was so spot on that she worried about other things like the size of the caravan
The
heating in the room
Or
the fact that she'd been put in a hotel above the bar. She would just come out with some awful sort of venomous remark about where she'd been put. But that was because she did the rest of it so well.
And was that sort of tongue-in-cheek, or was she a bit of a prima donna?
I don't think she was a prima donna. I think that's typecasting her far too much. Mm-hmm. She was really an absolute original and didn't say things for an effect. Never a smirk with anything she said. It was absolutely straight, spot on, which always made it much funnier because you weren't quite sure if she really meant it or not.
And she once suggested, I think, or maybe more than once, that she felt she'd got slightly siloed into comedy and therefore sometimes didn't get taken quite as seriously as she ought to.
Yes, possibly. I'm guilty of that because I worked on two comedies with her, but she could do so much. And I think that she saw classical acting as the peak of the biggest challenge, and doing the difficult plays on stage, that was her meat and drink. The more difficult it was, the more she'd have a go at it. So I think perhaps she just felt that comedy was almost too easy, but it isn't. Comedy, if you get it wrong, it's just hopeless, and you can tell. And she just never, ever got it wrong. But I can understand her wanting to do more sort of demanding roles, because she could do anything.
There's few of her generation left.
Yes, that's happening with much of the generation that I'm sort of part of now, really. I don't think there are many people quite like Maggie. She was an original, the great sort of theatrical dames of which she was one. I think she enjoyed their company a lot, and Judi Dench and people like that. She could be very, very warm and very, very loyal to friends.
But also quite private, I understand.
Yeah, she didn't like to be scrutinised, didn't like too much sort of peering into her own private life. I remember my daughter, who was quite young back then, about 10 years old, had a part in The Missionary, but she met Maggie. And Maggie was so good to her, and she kept asking years ahead, you know, how's Rachel? As though she was, you know, going on with the business. Rachel was by that time, you know, leaving school and going to college. But she cared about people she liked.
Michael Palin, reflecting on the life of Maggie Smith, and we'll be hearing a little bit more from Maggie Smith before the end of the programme. Coming up later, we'll bring you that story about the All England Club winning planning permission to build 39 new tennis courts on Wimbledon Park. Some local residents are worried about the environmental damage, and we'll hear from one of them, who's promising to go to extreme lengths.
I have said, and I mean it, and I said I'm 99 years old, I will find a way onto that area and I will chain myself to one of the trees so as to save one of the 800 trees.
That interview coming up shortly. But first, Benjamin Netanyahu at the UN this afternoon.
If you strike us, we will strike you.
Just as he was finishing his speech, huge explosions in Beirut's southern suburbs, plumes of smoke rising over the city as Israel targeted Hezbollah's headquarters. Several high-rise residential buildings were levelled to the ground and at least two people were killed and more than 70 wounded. The Lebanese Health Ministry said this number is likely to rise as rescue workers dig through the rubble. Lebanese MP Najat Saliba was in Beirut when the strikes hit.
I am living in Beirut and I've heard every single bomb. I heard the sound of the airplanes and we were all fearful for our lives. And God helps all the families that are now either under the rubble or they have their loved ones over there. I mean, it's really a catastrophe. It's a disaster.
Well, the BBC's Middle East correspondent Hugo Bachega is in the Lebanese capital, close to the scene of the strikes.
This is one of the roads leading to Dahir. We tried to get out of the car, but we were stopped by a group of men. There is chaos. There is tension. We've seen crowds gathered by the road with rucksacks and bags, apparently trying to leave Dahir.
Well, amid the destruction in Beirut, there was an element of spectacle in New York. The strikes came an hour or so after the Israeli Prime Minister began his address to the United Nations General Assembly. And some diplomatic delegates walked out of the hall in protest as Mr. Netanyahu approached the lectern.
Order, please.
It was an angry and impassioned speech when it came. He called the United Nations a swamp of anti-Semitic bile. He called Hezbollah the quintessential terrorist organisation with tentacles that span all continents. Israel had no choice, he said, but to continue targeting the group until its objectives were met. The one word that was not mentioned was ceasefire. But Mr. Netanyahu's greatest anger was aimed at Iran.
I have a message for the tyrants of Tehran. If you strike us, we will strike you. There is no place. There is no place in Iran that the long arm of Israel cannot reach. And that's true of the entire Middle East.
He went on saying that the world had not done enough to confront what he called the evil regime in Tehran.
For too long, the world has appeased Iran. It turns a blind eye to its internal repression. It turns a blind eye to its external aggression. Well, that appeasement must end. And that appeasement must end now.
Well, Ali Vaez is the director of the Iran program at the International Crisis Group, and he joins us now from New York. Mr. Vaez, thank you very much for being with us. The Iranian embassy in Beirut has called the strikes a dangerous, game-changing escalation. What's the reaction among Iranian officials to these strikes and to Mr. Netanyahu's speech?
It's great to be with you. I'm sure there is a degree of shock because there's been a series of massive setbacks for Hezbollah and Iran in the past few weeks, starting really from the killing of Hezbollah's number two in Beirut in July, and then the killing of Hania, former leader of Hamas in Tehran, on the inauguration day of the new Iranian president. And you continue the line all the way to the pager attacks and walkie-talkie attacks and these attacks in Hezbollah's neighborhood, killing almost the entire cadre of its leadership. It is certainly a major setback, and the Iranians are now faced with a dilemma, because if they respond, either directly or indirectly, they risk playing into Netanyahu's hand, from what they see, which is this idea of expanding the war and potentially dragging the United States into a direct military confrontation with Iran. But if they don't respond, then Israel can continue to move up the chain and further weaken Iran and its allies in the region.
We're getting some sense that Hezbollah in Lebanon is not quite feeling the support they want from Tehran. I read a quote from a Hezbollah supporter quoted in the Financial Times. "We're brothers," this man said, "when they need us, but where are they when we need them?" Is Iran cooling a bit on Hezbollah here, on its support?
No, I think that fighter is probably misunderstanding the general principle of Iranian approach here. What Iran calls its policy of hiring partners and proxies outside of its border is called forward defense. And the concept is that basically Iran would deter a direct attack on its soil by having these proxies that would give it strategic depth. The idea is never to fight on their behalf. The idea is that they would fight on Iran's behalf. Also, what happens to them has never been supposed to trigger an Iranian response. And Iran, throughout these years, it's not the first time Hezbollah has been in a war with Israel or Hamas has been in a war with Israel. It's also not the first time Israel has assassinated leadership of these groups supported by Iran. In 1992, it killed another leader of Hezbollah, and within 24 hours, that leader was replaced by Hassan Nasrallah. And in all of these scenarios, Iran has always stood behind Hezbollah, never with it or in front of it. And as long as it can continue to support it logistically and replenish its weaponry, that's all I think Iran would do.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Hassan Nasrallah. It's widely assumed and reported in the Israeli media that he, the leader of Hezbollah, was the target of that strike in Beirut today. Do you have any information on whether he indeed was the target, whether he was hit or not?
I don't have any credible, reliable information at this point, but it wouldn't be surprising if he was the target, given the fact that almost everyone in the high leadership of Hezbollah has already been eliminated. What I have seen confirmed in the Iranian media affiliated with the Revolutionary Guards is that a senior Iranian commander was also killed. The replacement of the commander that Israel killed at the Iranian consulate in Damascus on April 1st, which, as you remember, resulted in the massive Iranian attack directly from Iranian soil on Israel in mid-April of this year. So if you look at the, again, the pattern also in this attack, an Iranian general was killed. In the pager attack, the Iranian ambassador in Beirut was injured. And then there's the Hania killing that Iran has vowed to revenge. And so the pressure is building up on the Iranians. But they also understand that in the next 5 weeks prior to U.S. elections, it will be very difficult for the United States to exercise any kind of restraint on Israel. And so this is a window of opportunity for Israel. And it appears that Iran does not want to allow Israel to dictate the course of events and how the next steps in this escalation play out.
I was intrigued by hearing on Thursday Iran's foreign minister Abbas Araghchi saying that Tehran would not remain indifferent to Israel's war in Lebanon, but kind of suggesting that Hezbollah didn't need Iran's help.
Hezbollah decides for itself, and it is completely able to defend itself and to defend Lebanon and Lebanese people.
Is this kind of what's behind Iran's sort of restraint? Are they trying to change their policy?
No, as I said, this is consistent with their policy. They've never interfered in previous conflicts that Hezbollah or other groups have had with Israel or with U.S. and its allies. They always have approached this with a white glove kind of policy of trying to not get bloodied in the process, but inflict pain on their regional and extra-regional rivals at a minimum cost. But again, their options are becoming pretty limited now. And my sense is that they really believe that the next few weeks are an opportunity for Israel to goad them into a trap in which eventually they would have to face the much bigger power, which is the United States. And they want to do absolutely everything in their power to avoid that. And that's why we have seen restraint. And that's why I think the likeliest scenario is that we see continued Iranian provision of weapons to Hezbollah, but not its direct intervention.
Just briefly, we talk a lot about the possibility of a wider regional confrontation. How acute do you see that danger now?
It is as acute as it has ever been. I think the risk of regional conflagration is real, and it's very high because the one actor, Israel here, which is the wild card, basically feels that it has a blank check and it can do whatever it wants. So it's a major concern, and I think everybody has to take that into consideration.
Ali Vyas of the International Crisis Group, thank you very much. I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Wimbledon, the mainstay of British summer. Strawberries in the rain, picnics on Henman Hill, the gentle sound of balls being thwacked in 2 weeks of fierce but polite competition. Well, now a new plan to expand the home of the All England Club will turn this genteel suburb of southwest London into a huge industrial tennis complex. That's according to some local residents who've been campaigning against the development. The plans to build 39 new courts, including an 8,000-seater stadium on Wimbledon Park, have just been approved by the Deputy Mayor of London. In a moment, we'll hear from a 99-year-old local woman who's pledged to chain herself to the trees to prevent the development from going ahead. But first, Stuart Fraser is the tennis correspondent for The Times, and he joins us now. Stuart, thanks for joining us. You were at the hearing today. What was the reaction?
Yeah, good evening. Well, obviously, objectors very unhappy. Boos at the end when the decision was announced. Some crying, shame on you. That similar stuff happened last year when Merton Council initially approved the plans almost 12 months ago now. But that was a big moment for the All England Club today. Not only did they get the plans through the Greater London Authority, decided by the Deputy Mayor of London, but Angela Rayner, the Secretary of State, also confirmed that she would not be calling the plans in. So really, the only course of action now for the objectors is legal action.
It seems like a pretty big expansion. Why does the All England Club say they need it?
Yeah, so it's quite interesting. My position, I see the other Grand Slams around the world. I travel to the Australian Open, the US Open, and the French Open. And all these majors have grown at a remarkable rate over the past decade. They've effectively become three-week events. Qualifying is held on site the week before. You have kids' days, you have open practice sessions. Capacity has gone up, new facilities, not only for spectators, but for the players. And Wimbledon, in its existing site, has basically been bulging at the seams, to be quite frankly honest. It's been quite congested. They don't have the same number of facilities for players that the other Grand Slams do. And the All England Club have really felt for a long time that they needed an expansion to keep up with the other tournaments.
There is a sort of challenge in the works. Do you think that's likely to change anything, or do you think this is it now?
I mean, it's hard for me to say because it's not really been revealed yet what the exact nature of the legal action would be. There's talk of a judicial review, potentially something to the High Court, the Supreme Court. We'll need to see what happens with that. But it was interesting today. Initially, All England Club officials turned up at the hearing, knowing that this was just another step in the process. The objectors had long described it as a five-set battle. You had Merton, Wandsworth Council, the Mayor, the Secretary of State, and then potentially legal action. Effectively, the All England Club today have cleared two large hurdles in the process, and only one remains, and it looks like there could potentially be a spade in the ground next year.
And when do we think these new tennis courts might be being played on?
Yeah, so grass courts take a long time to put together and construct. To be honest, I don't think there'll be a ball hit over the road at the golf club, a tennis ball anyway, until 2030 at the earliest.
2030, right.
Yeah, it's looking like an eight-year construction period for the full project. So 2033 would be the completion date for the full thing, but they might be able to start qualifying over there in 2030 or 2031.
And just briefly, in the meantime, I understand that a lot of it has to do with whether qualifying rounds are played, and they'll be continued to be played elsewhere, will they?
Yeah, so at the moment they're 3 miles away at Roehampton, which is a nice site, the Bank of England Sports Ground, in terms of a temporary pop-up tennis tournament the week before. There's something intimate about it, but to be honest, it really falls short of the standards of a Grand Slam. So there's been complaints from players over the years about the nature of facilities there. So I think it's only right that Wimbledon are looking to bring that on site at this new expanded area.
Stuart Fraser, The Times tennis correspondent, thank you very much. That's the sort of pro-expansion view. For the other side, Thelma Ruby has lived in a flat overlooking Wimbledon Park for more than 30 years. It's a park she fears is now about to be bulldozed to make way for more tennis courts. I spoke to her earlier and began by asking her to describe the view from her window.
The full view is what keeps me going and what's kept me alive for many years. I can see a beautiful landscape designed by Capability Brown in the 18th century, full of glorious trees, lovely green grass, and at the back of it there's a lake. And it's just inspiring and just so beautiful, which it won't be if this happens.
Right. So what do you think is going to happen to it?
Well, the plan is, it's so terrible, I can't believe it's been passed. They're going to, in this day and age when trees are so precious for the planet, they plan to cut down, they say 300 trees, but experts have said it's going to be more like 800 mature, healthy trees. They're going to dig up all the grass because it's not the right grass for tennis courts. They're going to completely desecrate this landscape. They're going to have polluting lorries passing my window every 10 minutes with building material on it. They're going to take something between 5 and 10 years to do it. Unless I'm now 99 years old, I'm not going to see it completed, but I'm just going to have the rest of my life completely ruined.
Is this the end of the road? I mean, are you accepting that this is going to happen now?
No, I'm not accepting. First of all, we have a group of people. There are 20,000 signatures on the petition against it. And we have a very good group of people who say that this is not the end of the road.
There are several paths we can take to fight this decision today, and I hope that at least one of them will be successful. Because I have said, and I mean it, and I said I'm 99 years old, I will find a way onto that area, and I will chain myself to one of the trees so as to save one of the 800 trees.
Seriously?
Seriously, absolutely.
Well, you sound in fine fettle, Thelma Ruby, if you don't mind my saying so. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if you did.
I'm very, very lucky. I am actually in good nick for 99. Now, I'll be 100 next March.
Now, the All England Club and the people who are promoting this development, they say it'll bring in benefits to the economy, it will be good for the tournament. They're going to create a 23-acre public park where they're trying to recapture some of the original design of Capability Brown. That doesn't help sort of...
First of all, I don't believe them. I'm sorry, maybe I shouldn't say that.
Why not?
Because I really don't believe them. Secondly, it's just not true. It's always been a premier tournament, and it will continue always to be a premier tournament. There's just no question of it being any benefit. These new 38 new courts are for the 2 weeks before the tournament, which have always been somewhere else, and there's no reason why they can't go on being somewhere else. There's no necessity for it at all. Oh, maybe there'll be some building jobs or something, but I can't see any benefit at all. It's only be chaos here.
Are you a tennis fan?
Yes, I am. And I go every year, and I love tennis, actually. And I had one of the tennis people here to try and persuade me to change my mind. I sat her down in front of my view, and I said, what's going to happen? She said, oh, well, all those trees are going to be cut down, and between you and the lake, there'll be 8 tennis courts. And that's how she tried to persuade me to change my mind.
What did you say to her?
Well, I'm not going to even say it on the radio.
We'll be keeping an eye on that match. The All England Club versus Thelma Ruby will be 100 in March. Now, the US Vice President Kamala Harris, who's running to be president, is in Arizona on the border with Mexico later tonight, pledging to spend millions of dollars on tougher border security and implement immigration reform. Illegal immigration is one of the issues that large portions of the electorate care about most, and under her and Joe Biden's administration, it has hit record levels. Can Kamala Harris convincingly present herself as the one to tackle this issue, or will voters judge her promises to be too little, too late? Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, has been finding out.
Somos amigos! Somos Samaritanos!
What were you saying?
That we're friends and we're Samaritans.
Gail Kocherek is a volunteer who drives down to the southern border to hand out food and water to migrants who are on the Mexican side.
Hola.
Hola.
As she shouts, a small group of men emerged from the undergrowth where they were waiting until nightfall before crossing into the US.
Masawa, un momento.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
One 20-year-old Mexican man, who told us to call him Miguel, explained why he feels the need to risk entering the US illegally.
I only go to work. I want to help to my family for and give them a better life. I want to pay taxes. I want to work by the legal way.
But you'll be in America illegally and working illegally. Why is that better than working in Mexico?
Because in the United States you can save a little more.
We were talking through a large gap in the infamous border wall. It won't be difficult for Miguel and his companions to walk over into America, but it could be dangerous. It's nearly 40 degrees and hundreds of migrants die in the desert heat every year. Kamala Harris once called Donald Trump's beloved wall a medieval vanity project. But now she's promising more security, aware that this is her weakest electoral issue. But it will be tough to stop the migrants. Along the border, where the wall is in place, Gail showed me just how easy it can be to cut the steel and climb through.
Whoa, there's where you cut.
Right, because it's hollow there.
Yeah, there's no cement there.
When you hear Donald Trump or even Kamala Harris saying, you know, I'll put more resources in, I will secure the border, what do you think?
I laugh.
because I think it's really hard to do. It's easy to say and hard to do.
The first thing you notice about the border wall is it's not really a wall at all. It is a 30-foot-high rusting metal fence that snakes up and down the hillsides in this very rugged terrain. And then you get to a huge big gap where during the Trump administration they just left a big hole because it was difficult to run the wall across a stream. Well, there's a construction project going on now, paid for by the Biden administration, to fill in this Trump gap in the wall. As well as upgrading the infrastructure, President Biden also cracked down on asylum claims a few months ago, cutting by two-thirds the numbers coming in. Kamala Harris still has to explain why they left it over 3 years to take action.
What's this?
This is a water trough. I put in a drinking fountain for anybody who wants to come by and get a drink of water.
Jim Chiltern is an Arizona rancher who wants to stop migrants crossing onto his enormous 50,000-acre property. But he still provides drinking water because he also doesn't want people dying on his land.
In 2023, we had three people die on the ranch. And how many more are out there? I mean, 50,000 acres? How many dead bodies are out there that have never been found?
How do you feel about that?
I feel it's awful. No one deserves to die of dehydration. It's outrageous. That's why we need to secure the border.
He has set up motion-activated cameras that show thousands of people crossing his ranch every year. And he does not believe that if elected, Kamala Harris would stop them and secure that border.
And now she's changing her mind just to get votes and lie to us. Outrageous.
Why are you so sure it's a lie?
I've seen the evidence.
The landscape here in southern Arizona is vast and beautiful, with jagged mountain peaks stretching into the distance. It's also a key electoral battleground, territory where Ms. Harris knows she is vulnerable. That's why she's hoping to convince voters that she would get tough on immigration, which is, of course, Donald Trump's signature issue.
Sarah Smith, reporting from Arizona on the border with Mexico. Let's remind you of the headlines from the Middle East tonight. The Israeli military has bombed what it says is Hezbollah's central headquarters in Beirut, and a series of huge explosions have leveled buildings in the southern suburbs. Israeli media reports that the target was the Hezbollah leader, Hassan Nasrallah, but they don't know whether he was hit. The Lebanese authorities have so far confirmed 6 deaths, with a further 91 wounded, but the rescuers are digging for survivors. And that's nearly it from me and the World Tonight team. But before we go, let's go back to our top story. Dame Maggie Smith has died. And we thought we'd leave you with a little bit of this. It's her with the American comedian Carol Burnett from Carol's TV show in 1975, where Maggie, born in Ilford, Essex, is teaching her to speak with an accent. Good night.
Well, what sort of an accent do you want to learn?
English.
Well, no, that's quite simple, darling. We'll have you speaking the Queen's English in no time at all. You're a very quick starter. It won't take you any time.
That's lovely, but that's not the one I mean. I can't think of the type
Do you want to speak like the Beatles do? You know, the Liverpudlian one? Is that the one you meant?
No, that's not. It's the one where they go, ow.
I know what you mean. But within the sound of Bow Bells. You want Cockney,
mate? Cockney, that's it.
Oh, well,
okay, yes.
We'll try.
Okay.
Take the A sound.
Take the A sound.
Mike and I sound.
Mike and I sound.
Take the O sound.
Take the O sound.
Mike and Ow.
Mike and Ow.
Awfully good, old top. Now try a glottal stop.
A what?
A glottal stop.
Glottal stop.
What a lot of little bottles.
What a lot of little bottles.
God blimey. But ain't she the limey now?
I'm learning how. Take the A sound.
Take the A sound.
Make it an I sound.
Make it an I sound.
Take the O sound.
Take the O sound.
Make it an ow.
Make it an ow. Awfully good, you're doing great. Now drop your H's, mate.
How?
It ain't only the hurdling and the hopping over the high edges what hurts the horses' hooves. It's the hammer, hammer, hammer on the hard iron road.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.